I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm John Nelson. Today, Jan Hawken interviews Lauren Regan about a significant jury decision around protest this month in Eugene. Fran Mikkel tells us about the documentary soundtrack to A Coup d'Etat. Laurie Mercier interviews Desiree Hellegers about her web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. And finally, Julian Ankeny will read from Indigenous Voices in Poetry. First up on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Jan Hawken talks with criminal defense attorney and director of litigation and advocacy at the Civil Liberties Defense Center, Lauren Regan, about a jury decision in Eugene last month here in Oregon, where Justice for Palestine activists were participating, along with over 80 other cities, in a global day of action in response to calls from the people of Palestine. With more on that jury decision and why it matters, here's Jan Hawken with Lauren Regan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Lauren Regan.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jen.
Well, you are a defense attorney and director of litigation and advocacy at the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, and you've been on the program before to discuss legal issues and social justice activism. So thanks for coming on today to talk about the jury decision on January 23rd in the trial of Justice for Palestine activists related to the April 2024 Day of Action in Eugene last year. So there have been apparently 13 other trials so far, with two more trials scheduled. So what was different about this trial of Salam Yunus and Kay Anton, in addition to that being apparently the first not guilty verdict?
Yes, well, that was a positive change from the other trials. We really emphasized that this wasn't actually just an action in Eugene, that this was part of a global day of action that came as a result of a plea from the Palestinian people. It involved 82 cities, 19 countries on 6 different continents, and we really were able to testify to the jury regarding not only the reasons this day of action occurred, but also why the United States has a very unique role in trying to stop this genocide. You know, the clients Salem and Kay were able to discuss with the jury that the U.S. is responsible for almost 70% of the weapons and aid provided to Israel, perpetuating this genocide. And so the American activists were very successful in being part of this collective political movement where they blockaded weapons manufacturing facilities, numerous ports and other transportation corridors that were being used to ship weapons to Israel, and really were able to at least temporarily disrupt that flow of war machinery. In Eugene, over 60 activists safely blockaded traffic on the interstate, while over 50 more people gathered on a bridge overpass adjacent to the blockade location, and they held signs and banners during, you know, morning traffic. As a result, over 60 people were arrested and charged with state disorderly conduct charges. And over a dozen of the cases went to trial. In each one, we attempted to use the necessity defense.
The judge apparently ruled that out in pretrial motions.
Correct.
Can you say a little about that and whether that was a loss for the defense or what the issues were there?
I think we were able to put on choice of evils hearings outside the jury in each of the cases. And that's where we had experts like the UN Special Rapporteur on Starvation and the Right to Food, Michael Fakhry. And we had Oxford professor Cheney Ryan testify on all of the international crimes that were being committed both by Israel and the United States regarding these war crimes and genocide. And Professor Stan Taylor also talking about the efficacy of civil disobedience, particularly in the war resistance context, and particularly with regard to student movements and the power of student movements historically, whether we're talking about the Freedom Summer, during the Civil Rights era or Vietnam War, or today when we're talking about Israel's war crimes and genocide.
That's one of the critical criteria that you've described of the necessity fence, that it's a moral argument for the necessity of an action to confront a more threatening problem than
Correct, that the
whatever
crime
harder.
charged is less serious than the crimes that they were fighting against, that they were protesting against. But the court repeatedly ruled that the actions of the Eugene activists were symbolic, and therefore, under Oregon law, that the choice of evils defense would not apply. And that was the basis for the denial. And even though I think that decision was very wrong and was based on this one particular Ninth Circuit case out of Arizona, that is what the court ruled. And so we were stuck with that. But at trial, each defendant was able to take the stand on their own behalf and really almost repeat the testimony that they provided during the choice of evils defense. So we weren't able to put on the heavy hitter experts, but each defendant and some of their co-defendants were able to really eloquently inform the jury about what was at stake, what they did, why they did it, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for Salem and Kay, not only were they able to tell the jury very passionately about what was at stake and why they did what they did, but both of them, Salem is Palestinian American. He has family in Gaza and in Palestine. And Kay has family in Beirut, Lebanon, including a cousin that's an emergency room doctor. And they talked about how every day of their lives, they live their day fearing that their loved ones will be killed by Israeli airstrikes. And what it feels like to walk around a normal day with that on your heart and know that your people, your homeland, your family is literally being erased forever by a genocide. The land that you are attached to, the land that they had both been to and had visited is never, ever going to be the same. And I think that that testimony, in addition to all of the other stuff, really had an impact on the jurors. We were able to make some factual and legal defenses, of course, as well, which provided the jury with a roadmap to be able to find the defendants not guilty. And after about an hour and a half of deliberations, they came back with a unanimous not guilty verdict for both of them.
So the trial setting and perhaps the coverage of it allow the stories that have been so excluded or minimized or repressed by the dominant medium to be center stage, the story of these two people, protesters, who had such a deep personal tie to the losses and the violence. But is there some risk of relying on personal connection to the genocide in terms of that? Whether activists who are in solidarity with the Justice for Palestine movement, who are not personally affected by their pan in terms of their own family, but still have a moral obligation to act. Jewish Voice for Peace makes that argument that they feel a personal responsibility as Jews to stand up against many of the claims of the Israeli propaganda machine and the US government. But are there costs to relying on a personal connection to have your claims prevail in court?
Well, in this case, both of them did have deep personal connections, and that's why they testified to it. And I think that was totally appropriate. In general, I would say that when you are taking your political case to a jury, you need to build trust with those jurors and you need to connect with them. It's very difficult for a normal person to understand why someone would get up on a Monday morning and risk being arrested and criminally prosecuted. Often activists need to bond with jurors in order to be relatable to them. so that empathy, you know, can ensue and some understanding. And, you know, I think that it is often important for activists, regardless of their background, to really be able to tell the story of why they took the risks to their liberty that they did, you know, why it was earnest and serious, why they, you know, tried everything else before resorting to breaking the law, and why breaking the law was justified under the circumstances, particularly when you are talking about a genocide. You know, more than any other issue perhaps that we have dealt with in modern history, the fact that there is a genocide, a declared genocide happening around the world that we are 70% responsible for, in my mind, is of an entirely heightened and more serious caliber. Like when you think back to, you know, other war crimes and atrocities that have occurred historically, like what would have happened if Americans had just stayed in front of social media, you know, or played video games and just not have been engaged or not have educated their neighbors or not have really shown how deeply resentful and, you know, resistant to the actions of their own government they really were. You know, I think that is incredibly important when we're talking about global solidarity and particularly regarding genocide.
What were some of the critical dilemmas? Because as you just said, there's important form of solidarity and shared trust and commitment in taking risks that knowing the full weight of the law can come down on people. And some people are more vulnerable before the law than others. What were some of the dilemmas or choices that activists made around taking that action?
Well, as one of the lawyers, you know, I was not necessarily privy to those conversations, but what I would say is that all 60 plus defendants agreed to engage in collective defense, where one of the goals of their forced engagement with the legal system was that they would ensure that the more vulnerable folks in their group would not be left behind or were not left to face more serious consequences than others. And in the Lane County Circuit Court case, they were actually really tested on that, where everyone was initially offered a diversion agreement from the district attorney's office, except for two people. And one of the two people was Salem, this 19-year-old Palestinian American college student. And over 30 defendants in solidarity with Salem and this one other person, instead of taking the diversion agreement where they could have just basically got it dismissed from the record, they all set their cases for individual jury trials. And so we had over 30 cases that were set for individual jury trials while myself and others attempted to lobby and negotiate the DA's office to simply offer diversion to everyone. And the DA's office refused. And so that's why we saw so many of these cases going to full jury trials with choice of evils hearings in advance of them, you know, using up far more judicial resources than would have been needed if the DA's office simply offered a diversion agreement to Solomon and this one other person. And there really were no justified reasons for the state to refuse to offer diversion to Solomon and that other person.
But that's a real critical part of this process, you're saying.
Yes.
Making deals with people and can be very divisive and destructive in social movements as people make different deals and you have forms of solidarity breaking down.
Yeah, and that's why it was such a celebration that in the end, the one person who was not offered a diversion agreement and was in part why so many jury trials occurred in this, you know, in these cases, ended up being acquitted by a jury of their peers. You know, I hope that this will be something that our district attorney's office will reflect on in the future. And just, you know, everyone, all of the co-defendants were, you know, it made it worth it for them that, you know, Solemn was acquitted in the end.
So the spirits, it sounds like the spirits among the activists who've been through all this this year are kind of buoyed by the decision and that they've been able to hold together as a group in some way.
Yes, I think so. I think they have shown and remain in solidarity with each other.
You've been doing this work in the Civil Liberties Defense Center for a long time. You're involved in Standing Rock. I've met you many places through filming myself out in the field, in the courtrooms with work around climate justice, particularly the civil disobedience and the use of the necessity defense, supporting activists who want to go that route, the Black Lives Matter movement. Is there anything new you're seeing legally? I mean, some of what we're seeing around the country legally is, of course, right out of the usual playbooks. Is there anything you see different in the legal tactics or the degree of repression of activism with the Justice for Palestine movement?
Well, I mean, I would just say generally that with this incoming, you know, authoritarian Trump regime, we're seeing unprecedented demand for CLDC and Know Your Rights trainings and legal support. And we are bracing for the, you know, soon to be direct impacts on people and communities from the incredible levels of state repression that we know are already happening and, you know, are going to be getting worse. With regard to Justice for Palestine specifically, you know, I hope that the ceasefire holds. You know, I hope that the need for people to go to jail and risk their liberty in order to end our complicity in this genocide, you know, is over. But I am no naive human being looking at the writing on the walls. And so just today, actually, we defended U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights in a slap suit that was filed in Chicago in federal court in Illinois.
Can you just say briefly what a slap suit is?
Sure. It's called a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It's basically a frivolous lawsuit that is meant to shut down dissent and derail a political campaign. And in this case, you know, it was basically a Zionist dream come true, filed a federal complaint against a bunch of different Palestine human rights organizations and activists. And this morning in federal court, the judge dismissed our clients with prejudice, which means that they were dismissed from the case quickly before we even had to file a piece of paper, basically. And the plaintiffs in the case are not able to drag them back into the lawsuit. You know,
that was a victory.
That was a major victory.
Yeah, because in slap clear suits, when you hear lawyers describing the minutiae.
Yeah, I mean, slap suits.
Okay, good thing.
You know, the yeah, it's weird because in slap suits, the plaintiff is the bad guy, which, you know,
right,
that's not normally the way it is for us.
Right.
But and then our clients, you know, are made to be defendants. And so, you know, similar to the criminal defense work we do, the number one goal is to get them dismissed as soon as possible so their time and their resources and their work is not derailed or put on ice because they're in expensive federal litigation. So in the Palestine context, you know, we have been seeing a lot of slap type civil cases trying to suck up the capacity and resources of these organizations that are focused on Palestinian human rights work around the country and around the world. In the criminal context, you know, we've really seen sort of like, it really depends on location. You know, different jurisdictions have been handling cases very differently. You know, some jurisdictions like ours, even when people were convicted, they got community service, you know, as the punishment. In other places, like in New Hampshire, you know, there were some folks that blockaded a weapons manufacturing facility and they got, I think, 30 or 60 days in jail. So it's been a real mixed bag in terms of how the courts have treated Palestinian human rights activists thus far. And I can't imagine that things are going to get better, you know, sort of with unchecked fascism and authoritarianism leading the charge at this moment.
So, in concluding, how can listeners learn more about your important work? And you've been known for years for Know Your Rights trainings. They've been so important in arming. It's like sex education, the schools, safe sex. It's like safe activism. How to go
Or
out and
safer.
safer. It's a continuum, but because you've made this point that I've found really wise and persuasive before, that if people don't know their rights, they tend to pull back on the conservative side of the law. And
Yeah,
so
like they self-censor
you self-censor
themselves.
and it's inhibiting. So I think that's an important principle behind what you do. How can people learn more? You have a website, but are there specific trainings or programs coming up?
Yeah, I mean, we CLDC.org is our website, and on it we have a webinar library with dozens of different Know Your Rights and Risks trainings for street protests, for disabled activists, for immigrants and allies. We just did that one last week, and that is going to be publicly available widely, within the next couple of days. So definitely would steer people there. We also have a number of other resources, Know Your Rights brochures in Spanish and English and for youth. And we have a big digital security program, how to keep your tech safer, how to keep your cell phone safer, how to basically engage in this surveillance landscape with that little snitch in your pocket, which is your cell phone, and
While at the
how
same
to.
time maintaining solidarity and the relationships of trust that are so important in a movement.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. There are definitely ways to do all of it in a safer way. You just have to take yourself seriously and put in the time to learn some very basic ways to armor yourself and your community against state repression.
Well, Lauren Regan, thank you so much for being on the Old Mole Variety Hour here in KBOO this morning. Congratulations on that not guilty verdict and your important part in that and the activists themselves. And we look forward to having you on the show again.
Thank you, Jen. Appreciate
Keep
it.
up the good work.
Thank you.
Max Roach here on KBOO Community Radio. The song Freedom Day followed Jan Hocken with Lauren Regan here on KBOO Community Radio. Up next, Fran Mikkel tells us about the film Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, directed by Johan Grimon-Prez, documenting another protest in 1961 at the UN Security Council, where they and many others were protesting the murder of Patrice Lumumba, first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of Congo. Here's Fran Mikkel with more for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Patrice Lumumba was the first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of Congo, and had barely been in office a month when President Eisenhower handed down the order to CIA Director Alan Dulles to have Lumumba eliminated. Lumumba's crime, in the eyes of the U.S. and other Western powers, was his determination to control Congo's resources in the interests of improving the living conditions of the Congolese people. We learn more about that incident and its context in the documentary Soundtrack to a Coup d'État, directed by the Belgian media artist Johan Grimon-Prez. The film opens with, and returns to, the moment in February 1961 when singer Abby Lincoln, drummer Max Roach, writer Maya Angelou, and 57 other protesters disrupted a meeting of the UN Security Council to protest the murder of Lumumba. The Democratic Republic of Congo was one of 16 newly independent African countries admitted to the United Nations in 1960, a change that shifted the majority vote away from the old colonial powers. Although Belgium no longer officially ruled its former colony, the European power wanted to retain control of its riches. The United States wanted access to one of the world's biggest supplies of uranium, crucial to making atomic bombs, as coltan is today crucial to making cell phones. The United Nations, still a new institution, wanted to retain its authority and the backing of the USA. And rival politicians in the DRC were willing to ally with colonial powers for their own interests. Violence erupted almost immediately after Congo's official independence because the military was still under the control of white Belgian officers. Rank-and-file soldiers mutinied, Belgium sent troops to protect white colonists, and supported the secession of breakaway states within the Congo. The UN sent peacekeeping troops but refused to defend the newly independent government, so Lumumba sought Soviet support. The Congo crisis was a proxy conflict in the Cold War. In response to the unfolding neocolonial power grab, Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev banged his shoe on his desk at the UN General Assembly. Denouncing America's color bar and the UN complicity in the overthrow of Lumumba, he demanded immediate decolonization worldwide. The US State Department sent African-American musicians to Africa as jazz ambassadors, including Louis Armstrong, Nita Simone, Duke Ellington, and Dizzy Gillespie, purportedly to win African hearts and minds, but the US also sent covert CIA operatives along on their tours. By the time Lumumba was deposed, there were a dozen plots in the works to assassinate him, with the complicity of agents and mercenaries from the UK and Ireland, as well as Belgium, the US, and the Congo. Soundtrack to a coup d'etat weaves together the strands of this story, jazz style. It draws on a wealth of archival footage, as well as readings from texts by Central African Republic politician and women's rights activist André Blouin, Irish diplomat Conor Cruz O'Brien, Belgian-Congolese writer Nkole Jean-Bofin, and Nikita Khrushchev. And of course, the soundtrack is great. It's a dense and complex film, and at first I worried I didn't know enough to follow its complex interweaving of timelines and storylines, text and image and music, but by the end of its 2.5-hour running time, I had learned all this and more. Who knew that hired killers are so very fond of writing tell-all memoirs? And did you know Dizzy Gillespie once ran for president? Some reviewers have found there's too much going on in the film, and others have objected that some of the jazz musicians are presented as more naive than they were about U.S. government machinations, or that the film idealizes Lumumba's pan-Africanism. But if you have a library card and internet access, you can decide for yourself. Soundtrack to a coup d'etat is available to stream on Canopy through the Multnomah County Library. Here's some more of Freedom Day from We Insist, Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite.
Listen, whispers say we're free. Rumors flying must be lying. Can it really be? Can't conceive it, don't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, slave no longer. This is Freedom Day. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Throw those shackling chains away. Everybody that I see says it's really true. We're free. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Free to vote and earn my pay. Dim my path and hide away. But we made it. Freedom Day.
That was Abby Lincoln singing Freedom Day with drummer Max Roach following Fran Mikkel here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, Laurie Mercier speaks with Desiree Helligers, interviewing her about a new episode of her surreal web series, a black comedy set entirely inside the author slash performer's head. Desiree Helligers based the play, titled How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, on her own journals, making a compelling case for meditation, art, and comedy as powerful tools of anti-fascist resistance. Here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Laurie Mercier. I'm speaking with Desiree Helligers, professor of English, an affiliate of the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University, Vancouver, and one of the Mole reporters, producers in the Old Mole Variety Hour Collective. They have recently completed the second in a two-part web episode of How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, which they describe as a surreal, hallucinatory black comedy set entirely inside the playwright performer's head, based on journals written by Helligers during a 30-day Shambhala Buddhist meditation retreat in December 2005. Hey, Desiree, great to have you on the other side of the mic to talk about this hilarious series.
Thanks for making time to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell us about this web series and what inspired it.
Well, so I went on this 30-day silent Buddhist retreat in 2005. Katrina had happened in August. This was December. I had spent some time in the West Bank in the spring. And there were so many disclosures happening about torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and Bagram. You know, so much U.S. military violence happening, and George Bush, the younger Bush, had at one point very recently referred to, you know, the war on terror as a crusade. We were seeing so much evidence of the climate crisis accelerating. And I felt, as I think we all do right now and in moments of crisis, like I really wanted to entertain myself. I really wanted to be distracted. And I felt like it was a critical moment to kind of confront whatever the noise is that we run from in our own heads perpetually. And so I signed up for this extended Buddhist retreat. It was just a pretty surreal experience of sitting in nearly total silence for 30 days with only what's called functional talking and kind of Dharma talks in between. There was something I would consider almost like a hand ballet, a thing called orioke, which is a practice that you do, you know, when you're eating and cleaning your dishes, and you're never ever getting up from the cushion to do that, right? So other retreats I'd been on, you know, you get up, you'd have lunch, you'd have kind of a stress break or whatever. And in this case, it was much more of a powder keg emotionally and some ways physically, I guess, as well, because you were sitting so continuously doing walking meditation as well. But there wasn't a lot to kind of break that tension. And I had been on a week-long silent Buddhist retreat earlier. I'd been on a Catholic retreat for a week that was silent back in the 80s. But it was my first experience, I think, of having fairly vivid flashbacks to moments in the past, being hit with kind of a barrage of pop culture memes and fragments and all of the kind of texts that sort of make us up as human beings, and that we are generally disengaged from all of that noise that's floating around in our heads. And I think we're looking for ways to quiet it with more noise. And so I think extended silent retreat of this kind of allows you to have to confront that. There's just no way of getting around it. And I ended up having some very vivid flashbacks to traumatic experiences that I had in the past. And that's kind of the center of the second episode, you know, how I accidentally killed my father, which flashes back. And I think of it as like time traveling, like Billy Pilgrim and Slaughterhouse Five, that we mentally are often time traveling. You know, it looks like we're both sitting here, we're occupying the same space and moment, but in fact, we're constantly flashing back to other moments in our lives and other experiences that we've had. And in this case, I time travel back to the 1940s, where my father was a child escaping the Nazi invasion of the Netherlands in the 1940s, and then sort of travel forward to the 1960s, where I am consuming tons of American cultural junk food while watching villages burn in Vietnam between commercials. So I think I was very much preoccupied by war and by the way in which we're drifting toward fascism in the U.S.
Well, it seems to me the title itself, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, is both a critique, as the play and the performance are, I think, both a critique of the military-industrial complex in important ways, but it also appears to critique the meditation-industrial complex as well. As you were saying, you're at this retreat supposedly to get away from war and the growing fascism in the United States. But you're also unable to have all those images that we're constantly bombarded with escape. So you grew up as a very devout Catholic, and that's apparent in the performance. And so in addition to the Buddhist influence you reference, you imagined your life as becoming a saint, or how you might dream of becoming a saint. So tell us more about that portrayal in the play.
I went all the way through, you know, grade school, high school, Catholic schools, Catholic university. I went into the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I was on a reservation in Montana where they were in the process of covering up clerical sexual abuse. I began to get some sense of the kind of colonial violence that the church had participated in. And I saw a huge amount of like racism that was still practiced by the clergy, the disengagement from the poverty in their midst. And that really was my breaking point in many ways with Catholicism. But I still end up spending a lot of time with radical Catholics in Seattle. And I ended up meditating and being introduced to Buddhism by folks there with the Catholic worker who had been down in LA and had begun meditating at the LA Zen Center. So my real entrance into Buddhism was, oddly, these kind of Catholic Buddhists. You know, I don't think they necessarily were identified with the hierarchy of the church on any level, but their social justice work was still animated by a lot of those principles. So I guess in some ways, the series is sort of taking some of that skeptical lens that I honed as a kind of post-Catholic and applying them to some of what I was witnessing in this Shambhala Buddhist retreat. And, Shambhala would go on to have, Shambhala had some really troubling history with Chogyam Trungpa, had some really troubling behavior. There was kind of a history of sexual abuse of, Shambhala teachers going back to like the 1960s. And then it erupted again in another wave with Chogyam Trungpa's son in about 2018. And so I found myself really thinking about the ways in which master-disciple relationship can really, set us up for all kinds of abuse, but the way in which it's also inextricably linked, in my mind anyway, to other forms of authoritarianism, right? So that really struck, of course, I think we all are now probably, by so much of the kind of right-wing Catholicism that seems to be shaping the decisions of the Supreme Court. And strangely, I kind of look at this play as interfaith dialogue of sorts between Catholicism, Christianity, and Buddhism. I might be wandering far afield from your question.
Well, you, in addition to exploring faith and the impact of faith and spirituality and meditation on your life, I think it's the second episode of this series that you explore the impacts of your father's death on you as a teenager. And what is the larger story you're trying to explore about the intergenerational impacts of war and fascism?
I'm going to wrap back for a second to your earlier question, too, because I think there is a kind of spiritual materialism that all of us can fall prey to in whatever spiritual tradition we're in, right? Where we kind of fetishize some level of spiritual attainment. And in the context of, Catholic sainthood, it's like being the star of the show. You get to be like, Bernadette in the Song of Bernadette.
So magnificently did Jennifer Jones interpret the part of Bernadette, the peasant girl in Franz Werfel's The Song of Bernadette, that from the moment this great motion picture was first publicly presented, there was no doubt that it had given the world a new, incomparable star.
Or you're like St. Francis and Brother Sun, Sister Moon, which is like one of my favorite films growing up. So all of these pop culture influences are also kind of in dialogue with these spiritual texts and practices. But, specifically with my father, who was also devoutly Catholic and remained so throughout his life, to me, and I don't want to kind of give away the circumstances of his death, but he definitely suffered from malnutrition and from other kinds of medical or health traumas, partly as a result of being a child refugee of the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. And, my father had a lot of health issues in his life that were, to me, directly traceable to the effects of fascism, of militarism, of war. And in 2015, I actually went on a delegation to Vietnam with Veterans for Peace and learned that 50 years after the American war in Vietnam, more Vietnamese people had been killed by unexploded ordnance in that 50 years than American GIs died during the war. And so to me, it's war explodes across decades. It's never over when it's over. And, the U.S. now has this long history of using weapons that contaminate the landscape of these countries, possibly in perpetuity, right? Especially without serious remediation. And the U.S. has, never paid reparations to Vietnam. And we know that the U.S. has left, all this depleted uranium in the Middle East. And we know that in Iraq in particular, they've seen many of the health effects in children being born with terrible disabilities in the same way that we're also seeing in Vietnam. And so, I think the other thing that the series tries to do is kind of name names. These corporations have names, right? We know in the aftermath of the Holocaust that there were so many American corporations that collaborated, right, to create that industrial scale death. And my family was incredibly fortunate as Catholics, having money to be able to flee, to be able to get to England and be taken in as refugees. And so many, certainly, Jewish refugees, other refugees, queer LGBT folks who just would not have been greeted with those same open arms and as a result died in the camps. So war is never over when it's over. It's like a timed release bomb that's always going off and that affects generation after generation. And I couldn't even produce this segment with images of, you know, we've got some images in there of children, child refugees being fed at feeding stations by the Red Cross or whomever in those war zones. And I definitely was thinking of Gaza in that, right? We're seeing so many health effects of children in Gaza and so many tens of thousands of people who've been killed and so many children who've been orphaned.
It seems to me that just recently, the mainstream media, in fact, I just heard something on NPR, expressing some horrors of the utter destruction of Gaza, as if they had not been aware of what massive bombing U.S. bombs have done for the last 15 months. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the long-term effects, so people are horrified by the rubble, but not thinking about the environmental consequences, the health impacts, not to mention the actual people who have been killed, but the many more who will die in the future from the inability to access adequate health care. And for the past 25 years, the United States has basically destroyed the Middle East without achieving a single political objective. So I think that's a powerful part of your web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. But one thing I love about the series are the somewhat sarcastic references to popular culture. What are some of the pop culture touchstones that you decided to integrate into this production and their relevance to the more serious subjects explored, especially the Vietnam War?
Especially in the first episode, I mean, there's some stuff about, I think it's DuPont, right? You know, these old kind of clips of DuPont from the 1950s or 60s, Better Living Through Chemistry kind of song and dance.
Better things for better living through chemistry for the finer world we want.
Knowing the incredible damage that Dow has done to Vietnam and the destruction of triple canopy jungle and the ongoing health effects of Agent Orange. So those kind of clips seem to me deeply ironic. I mean, I think we were talking earlier about how creepy one of the Barbie ads is.
If you had Mattel's Barbie in some of her new outfits, just think of the fun you could have together. You can tell she's Mattel. She's swell.
Barbie becomes kind of this recurring figure, and also the Sound of Music, right? Because as a Catholic family, as refugees from the Holocaust, that film always really resonated for me. But also the Brady Bunch, right? Marsha. I mean, I felt like I went through a couple of days where all I could hear in my head while I was trying to meditate was like, Marsha. You know, these kinds of earworms that get in your head and they're rumbling around in there in ways that we're not even conscious of until you sit down and sit in silence and can't escape them. But I think to me, when I look back on the Brady Bunch and I think, you know, where was the Vietnam War there, right? I mean, where was the episode where Greg burns his draft card? It was like the war was completely erased from so many sitcoms that I grew up watching and all of this. And then we would see the violence of the war on the news, but without any kind of frame for understanding that. I sort of reimagined some of those sitcoms kind of later on in the play. But, you know, I also just want to say something quickly about torture, too, because those disclosures of torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, I think in the series, really kind of picking up on the ways in which fetishization of torture, right, the image of the tortured Jesus that so many of us kind of have pounded into our heads, where there's a kind of fetishization of torture, but it's so disengaged from those of us who are white in the U.S. or middle class, comfortable. And I have questions about what does it mean to believe in a torturer God, right? How did we become in the U.S. so steeped in the logic and rhetorics of torture? And I think that is inextricably linked to kind of faith in a God who's a God of torture. So I think in some ways, I'm sort of teasing out some of the worst of these traditions, but also wanting to celebrate the best of them. And I did end up taking refuge vows as a Buddhist on Christmas Day, which seemed very, very appropriate to me. But I also direct a lot of skepticism toward people taking bodhisattva vows and promising to come back lifetime after lifetime to addressed suffering. And there's a part of me that's like, wait a minute, hello, I'll give you a ticket to Iraq right now. You don't have to wait till the next lifetime. If you want to have that experience, you can have it right now. And that's kind of some of the skeptical critique that's going through my head, because I do think that we have so much wealth and privilege and are so disengaged from the incredible suffering that our tax dollars are meting out in so many places, but certainly especially in the Middle East. And then we're sort of simultaneously getting spiritual cred for imagining ourselves as kind of peace agents. And I don't want to get too cynical here, because I do believe that in the best of these traditions. And I think it's really important right now that we do have interfaith dialogue, and that for those of us who are Catholic or come out of that tradition and see the ways in which Catholicism is being really weaponized on the Supreme Court, politically in the US and globally, that we need to be able to talk to other people and try to make space for a different kind of spirituality, one that is possibly much more based in the actual words of the Gospels, if you're coming at it from a Christian tradition.
To break away from the hypocrisy that becomes unbearable at times. Mm-hmm. And Desiree Helgers, thank you so much for sitting down with me today to talk about this amazing production. Folks can find it on the web. We'll link to the Open Signal website on the Old Mole Variety Hour webpage. This is Desiree Helgers' web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. Do you want to say anything more, Desiree, about how people can access this?
You can go to the tinyurl.com/5AUV4UZB. That's tinyurl.com/5AUV4UZB. And I do want to just do a shout out to my two amazing collaborators, Melissa Salazar at Open Signal Community Media Center and Daria Ruggles. So shout out to these amazing collaborators, without whom this wouldn't have been, certainly would not have been possible.
Well, again, we'll link to the web production at Open Signal on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. Thanks again, Desiree.
Thank you, Lori.
Your Trouble, that's Belmont Club here on KBOO Community Radio, following Lori Mercier and Desiree Helgers. Now, to conclude this week's episode, here's Director of Native American Programs at Washington State University, Vancouver, creative writer Julian Ankeny, reading Indigenous Voices in Poetry on KBOO Community Radio.
First, I will be reading a poem by Nasser Rabba, Letter to the Pilot Returning to the Base After Bombing Gaza. You might be taking off your heavy military helmet, smiling to those who greet you, and they might be congratulating you on a safe return from a very risky mission, but you are the only one who well knows what you have done. Shame on you. Shame on you. Spread dust over your head. Spit at your face in the mirror. Is this what you've been taught? To fight the houses and the streets? Have no missiles against your fighter jet that flees through plainless sky? And when you watch our children under rubble on your TV screen, they wave their hands in victory, even when dead. Our next poem is called In the War, Hymn and Houses by Mosab Abu Toha. You fight, you die. You never know who won or lost, or if the war ever ended. When the bomb fell, the shrapnel cut your body's clothes, your flesh. It cut your country's flag, its landscape. They didn't find a place to bury you. They carried you on their shoulders, wandered in the neighborhood, stopped at your children's school and the old park. Everything saw you except for the houses. Houses have packed their bags. Dust has erected a tent in the angles. Rust has landed with its worn out clothes on the tab and on the spoon. It steals from the water its soft slide, whereas the air sleeps on the spoon's rough earth, while you sleep on moving sand. This poem is for all the mothers everywhere. In Gaza, a mother never sleeps, by Nima Hassan. She listens to the dark, searches its edges, sorts out sounds, sound by sound, to select a suitable story to read her kids to sleep. When they sleep, she stands up to shield them from death. A mother in Gaza does not cry. She folds up fear, rage, and prayers in her lungs and waits for the hum of warplanes to fade, then exhales. A mother in Gaza is not like other mothers. She bakes bread with her own eyes salt. She feeds her children to the homeland. This poem is for all of our children. May they remain safe. From A Lullaby from Gaza by Taysir Abu Odeh. We've inherited ancient chores. We count martyrs, we count wounds. How many amputated legs? We record wrecked ships, buried dreams, and murdered goats. We survey slaughtered olive groves, count out our sleeping pills. We store memories in the attic of Arabic and stand in the rubble at dawn. We recall lullabies. We rename chrysanthemum, rename cities and citadels. We take the alley. To what ends? We say every poem is a ladder up to the gates of Jerusalem. This poem is dedicated for all our tomorrows. The Conditional by Ada Limon. Say tomorrow doesn't come. Say the moon becomes an icy pit. Say the sweet gum tree is petrified. Say the sun's a foul black tire fire. Say the owl's eyes are pinpricks. Say the raccoon's a hot tar stain. Say the shirt's plastic ditch litter. Say the kitchen's a cow's corpse. Say we never get to see it bright. Future stuck like a bum star, never. Coming close, never dazzling. We say never meet her, never him. Say we spend our last moments staring at each other, hands knotted together, clutching the dog, watching the sky burn. Say it doesn't matter. Say that would be enough. Say you'd still want this, us alive, right here, feeling lucky. For our last poem, a poem for the ancestors and for us to live a long and healthy life. Remember, by Joy Harjo. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon. Know who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. And this is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away tonight. Remember your birth. How your mother struggled to give you from a breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are earth. Remember the plants and trees and animals, life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind, remember her voice. She knows the origins of the universe. Remember, you are all people and all people are you. Remember, you are this universe and this universe is you. Remember, all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember, language comes from this. Remember, the dance language is that life is. Remember.
Julian Ankeny for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 3rd of February, 2025. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Julian Ankeny, Laurie Mercier, Fran Mikkel, and Jan Hawken, and to their guests Desiree Helligers and Lauren Regan. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of the Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.